You're listening to Latour's favorite radio station, 66.6 The Lore.
All right. This is Fables of Latour Radio, and you're listening to Lore Dump. I'm your host, Devin Hayes, and with me today is a special guest, none other than the man, the myth, the legend himself, Quentin Foote.
Well, it's a real pleasure to be here, Talon. Thank you so much. Should I say Devin Hayes?
You're welcome. Welcome. We're glad to have you. So, how's the wife? How's the kids?
Oh, you know, the wife is great. The kids, they're running amok, but what can I say? It's life.
Well, what are you going to do?
No, just for anyone wondering, I don't have kids, but I do have a wife.
Does have a wife. That is a flex. So, I know why you're here. You know why you're here. Let's inform the people. We're going to interview Quinn on his world and his books, the podcast, you know. Get them all in there. So, now that I've got the jokey dumb questions out of the way, we're going to start with this one. What drove you to have the Dragonbloods and Dwarves, the sworn enemies, like the Keast and Kintar?
Oh boy, you're just really coming out of the gate swinging here, Devin.
What can I say? I'm a home run kind of guy.
If I had to, like, honestly, I find that, like, a lot of this whole, like, storytelling bullcrap comes out of, like, convenience. You know, like, what two things can you just, like, smush together? And so, like, honestly, like, for any listeners, you can go to our Instagram and look at our map of Latour. And that's just where I began. I was like, okay, so we're going to make this podcast. It's got to be on Latour. And in the books, The Mighty Vendivar and The Siege of Shadow, we really focus on... Book three coming soon, yes. And like, so we really focus on the Great Northern Rainforest as a whole, which is like pretty much the north bit of Latour, and then the east in Shadowscorn. So like that area had already been like really explored. So I was like, well, let's head west for the podcast. And the two biggest countries there are the Dwarves of Silver Rock and the Rogarians. And Dwarves are already like so known for being like dicks. Yeah.
Okay, good, we're on the same page.
And I feel like when you're the Dragonbloods of Latour are descended from Skalgr, the Diamond Dragon, the God of Death, which we will cover a little bit later on in this episode, if you're like his direct descendants, like his very own species, you're gonna have a little bit of attitude behind you.
That's fair.
It makes sense.
Two
right?
Very proud races, and
their neighbors.
Their neighbors, they got a difference in a lot of opinions. So,
yeah. So that was all right. That all came to fruition.
Makes sense. There's a second question here that I think is a follow up, but doesn't grammatically make sense to me because I can't read my own writing. So we'll skip that one and go to what originally was Perdition Island? Was it always for convicts? Like, to me, it has this very, like, how Australia at one point was, like, where you would send your British bad people. Yeah. So is that, was Perdition Island always like that, or did it kind of develop a spooky?
Honestly, I feel like Perdition Island, it's just kind of like this lone, creepy island in the Half Moon Sea. And I'm trying to think of like the inspiration, you know, like even like in like Return of the King, when like Aragorn and Legolas and Gimli go to like that mountain and there's a whole like city of fucking ghosts in there.
Ah, yes.
I was like, well, that's a classic trope. And I feel like, so to get off a little bit topic here, like the magic of Latour like radiates from the core, like the planet itself radiates magic. So I imagine there being like hot spots, you know, across like the surface, and eventually there's gonna be like a dark necrotic type magic that just kind of like clusters and groups together. And I just kind of picked Perdition Island for that because again, let's just like smush topics together. Faye speaks to the dead, and I needed to find a way for her to commune with her caretaker, a power who was kind of like the Grim Reaper of Latour, but a little less grim. And so it just kind of worked out that a little more Reaper than a little less grim, you know? So that's just kind of how that kind of came to be, and just convenience of it all. And who doesn't like a spooky island, you know, full of cannibals too. It's not even just bad guys. It's not even just bad guys and ghosts. It's cannibals.
You got everything. You hit all the bad guy tropes for a creepy island. You went,
right.
You went, there's the Hills Have Eyes with cannibal creepy people. We'll put them on an island. There's ghosts. We'll put them on an island.
And then they'll be one big happy family.
Exactly. We can all get together. I'm going to save. So
what was your grammatically difficult question? Let's weed through that together.
What happened to the city of the prior age that buried it? I'm not really sure what that's referring to. That's someone else's question that I rewrote. And
I was wondering if that was like referring to the three gates.
I think he means the city. Yeah, city under the three gates.
Yeah, that's kind of what I'm thinking.
That makes sense to me. And now that we've gotten to there.
Yeah. And like, you know, throughout the first season, we've really like, we spent some time in the Three Gates. It's a fun city.
Yeah.
It's definitely like the second biggest city in the West, I believe. Maybe the first. I'd have to check my notes. It competes with Sarenstrom.
Okay.
But like, I don't know. It's just kind of like a thing about history. Like, you know, in ancient times, your city would get flooded or some natural disaster would happen and everything would kind of get ruined. But you've like built your life here. There's like good land around. You've already got like these structures around. And so let's just build the next city on top of that crap. And that's just like,
makes sense.
You'll find examples like that all across the world. Right.
That's true. You got your creepy, crypt things in France with skulls everywhere.
Yeah, exactly, right? And like when we went to Italy, it was like we went to we stayed in Napoli, which is Naples, and like there were quite a few tours where you could just like go 40 or 60 feet underground and just explore the city that was there before modern Naples kind of thing. And that was really cool. So just taking inspiration from like real life, you know, experience like that too.
That makes sense. Respect that. So You sort of talked about how in the books you really focused in the Great Northern Rainforest. Would you say that that's like the first culture you developed as well? But for the Keast, was that your first?
Yeah, I would definitely say so. I Canute, who plays Nordum, we always give him a hard time because they always like to play Dragonborn in all of our other like Faerunian campaigns. And he pointed out one time that I always play elves and nobody ever gives me a hard fucking time about it. And that is so fair because I always play an elf and I'm always looking for like a different kind of elf to play.
Mm-hmm.
And for those who don't know me, which is probably lots of people listening to this, I grew up on Vancouver Island, British Columbia, which if you don't know about it, you should quickly Google that because it is one of the most beautiful places in the world.
But don't visit, please. I don't want your traffic.
No, yeah. Stay away.
You can look at pictures. That's all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. But it's a boreal rainforest. It's the west coast of Canada. It's rugged, stormy.
We have pretend winters.
And so I was just like, well, I love forests and I love the ocean. I'm going to make a coastal elf because I had never seen anything like a coastal elf before. You know, you've got your atypical like wood elves like Legolas and that's an old trope. But like the Keast heavily.
It's a forest elf though.
Yeah, right?
That's not a I'll dive for hours for food elf.
Exactly. So the Keast have evolved to live on the ocean. They're very tall, so they've learned to climb the trees that are kilometers tall. So yeah, the elves of the Keast elves are pr- probably my first culture I created. And then I needed bad guys, right? Because you got to have the classic.
Yeah, you got to have bad guys.
Got to have your classic bad characters to push and test the good characters. So that's where the Kintar came in. And fuck the orc trope. So I was like, well, let's have elves that are like barbaric and huge, muscular, and have
and just
evolved.
Kind of dickheads.
Yeah, just kind of assholes. And not even that they're
except
necessarily assholes.
Love you, Corpse Paint.
Except for Corpse Paint. We love you, Corpse Paint. Rest in peace. But it's just like it's their culture, right? It's like they're not.
Yeah.
They're not just dicks to be dicks. It's like they worship the god of battle, and that's how they pray. That's how they show their reverence is through battle. So yeah, it's a whole other deep dive we could do, but. Those were the two cultures I definitely first created and had a blast and still love exploring.
Yes. Just as a prior listener turned member of the podcast, hearing about how the Kintar and the... Also, I've, as a recent listener of the audiobook, get the audiobook, available at audible.com. I don't know. Go there. You'll figure it out. It was cool to hear just how, because in the podcast, for example, we kind of explore a more willing to give up the old ways, I would say, version of the Kintar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Whereas in the books, the Kintar are very much, I mean, to be fair, it could be like a specific tribe of the Kintar, not the Kintar as a whole. Let's be generous on that, or a little more fair. They very much are still like, fuck the Keast.
Yeah.
And when at last we left off with the Kintar, they were a little more like, I guess we could see where if they're all right.
Yeah, right. So,
it's interesting to feel the difference and like not just decide that like this whole, entirety, because you like, for example, you have Christians in Canada, you have Christians in other places that have very different ways of practicing, and so it was interesting to have like this entirely like straight back to the fuck the Keast idea after, because I had listened to the Kintar that were a little more looking forward to change, I would say, before I indulged in the book. So it was interesting to feel the difference,
which is a really, really like, it's a special neat thing about like our podcast is that like this is, well, yeah, it's first of all, it's based off books, and then second of all, it's 10 years before the first book, so it's really neat that like you can have this like almost different era, right, of like of how the world looks and how things feel and things progress quickly. So it's something that sets our content apart from others for sure.
Yeah, and I can also see that like the Quake of Herezoon could have like fucked the Kintar, and the Kintar were like, we have no choice but to go back to this now. Like there's, we haven't gotten to that point between the book and the podcast to really explore what happened.
Yeah, and I will say it's a big topic in book 3. Is the Keast and the Kintar having to officially like come to some kind of agreement, because shit's changing.
I put that on the back burner. But to go with culture, tell me about your pantheon.
Oh boy. I gotta say, like, the pantheon is probably the thing I've enjoyed some of the most of creating. I just had a blast with it. I think it's really neat. And like, I'm not a religious person. But I'm fascinated by religion and the religions of the world. Definitely more on the ancient side of things.
Fair.
So it was really neat getting to just kind of do a dive on, you know, Nordic religions and the old Japanese religions and the Celtic gods and all that kind of stuff. So that was really fun.
I'm a sucker for some ancient Greek history.
Yes. Big time, big time, big time. So right off the bat, we have Aesir, god of shadow and assassins. And his creed or dogma is only in darkness is one truly revealed. And of course, he is the all-father of sorts to the Shadowscorn, which we can talk about here shortly. We have Aiana, who is the god of forests and land. And his dogma is, be resilient as grass, sweet as fruit, strong as stone, and a sprawling heart like the roots which you walk upon. We have up next is Braylon Stonesower, who is a pretty prominent god in our first season of the podcast, with Nordum being a paladin of Braylon. He is the god
and
of
always
justice.
In timeout.
And always in timeout, yes. Don't piss off your god, players, because gods are cruel and not very forgiving. So he is the all-father of the dwarves, god of justice. Dogma is, what once was can never be again. Again, getting back to that severity of dwarves in general, and the god of justice being a little bit of a hard ass. Next we have Kaya, who is the goddess of the sea and storms. Her dogma is, let the sea set you free, or fight the waves and find watery graves. And at any point, feel free to stop me if you have any questions about these, powerful radio host, Devin Hayes.
I do have a bit of a question. I'm in the books, she is mentioned, Kaya, and forgive me, but I can't recall the second queen's name. I want to say it's like Ilaria or something like that.
Trilara?
Isn't that the first one?
I wrote these. Oh, God.
Pretty sure Trilara is the original queen, and then Ven gives temporary power to the other lady that I cannot recall the name of. But when they go on their hunt, she talks about. But she mentions Kaya when they go on their hunt, I don't think we really hear anything else about her. Me personally, I'm exploring this deity specifically for a character idea. So I'm a little curious as to what we got to go on. What do you have in her bag of tricks?
Yeah, so the Keast being coastal elves, they worship Kaya and Aiana. And so Kaya and Aiana are lovers. They're the only gods in the pantheon who have actually paired off permanently. Again, of course, because the land and the sea are synonymous and balance each other out. So Kaya is very like the sea, can turn on a dime from a beautiful sunny day to a raging hurricane. And what breaks a hurricane? The land. And so for that, you know, they kind of balance each other out. But her whole thing is people all over the world of Latour worship her for a number of reasons. Latour is so huge that a lot of trade happens through the sea and all the rivers, because you can get through a lot of Latour just through all these different fjords and rivers.
All right.
So she's not mentioned in the books too much, just because Ven is, he doesn't deny the fact that the gods live, but he doesn't find any use in them.
Okay. Understandable.
But again, something that we can explore further in the second season and in the books. A lot in the third book, again, I should add. This is all about the gods and the species in the third book, so.
Okay. So we got to Kaya. Who's up next?
Lokor, again, the deity of corpse paint. He is the god of battle, and I should emphasize battle, not war.
He must be a really big fan of battle bots.
Yeah, I mean, everyone's gotta have their hobbies, right?
Battle bots was great. Don't at me. Great.
So he is just like anything, like nature battles every day, like predator and prey kind of thing. The fight for survival, that is what Lokor is, and kind of mediates over Latour. And his dogma is perseverance is the measure of power. So it's not how strong you are, but you know, how, what is your endurance? What do you continue to put up with before you kind of give in?
Lokar sounds kind of like the lesson of, well, like you say, enduring. Like, it's not always about what you can give out, but what you're willing to continue to carry, I guess.
Yeah, 100%.
So he I just found like an outside perspective. He seems very, you can see how the Kintar are like, oh, well, I gotta battle, I gotta show that, like, I can do this type of thing.
Yeah. And that's why they're, like, such hardy people. Is it's like, they're just gonna put up with whatever life throws at them and not give up. It makes them incredibly tough and fearsome. Up next, we have Pyrelia. She is the goddess of fire, birth, and renewal. Her dogma is the hottest fires brand strength incarnate. So she, similarly to Lokor, is you know, what are you gonna put up? You know, what are you gonna do when fisticuffs come up? But really, like, the birth and renewal and the fire is kind of like when a forest fire rips through. The forest always grows back, right? It's just like a clean slate kind of thing. And her chosen are actually Phoenix Folk, which is one of our homebrew races. And that is, she picks people who have died with, like, great injust. So someone who was just cheated out of their life. And she grants them the gift of a new life, a rebirth, and as one fucking hella powerful creature.
We actually meet a Phoenix Folk in the podcast, for those of you, like, who don't remember.
Yeah, she's
it's in pretty quick. It's like
seven, or
just
something?
After
eight?
Yes, just after the original, the OG Red Willow Guild gets
oh dear,
handled, we'll say.
Yeah, handled. Oh yeah, it's episode. It's the Willow Guild Part One arc. If you, any listeners, are interested in rehearing that. But yes, moving forward, Mahem is the god of chaos, and his dogma is burn to build and build to burn. Chaos is the world blood. And this is something that, like, me, Quentin, has really embraced in life lately, that life is just fucking chaotic. Maybe it's not that there's no rhyme or reason to it, but there's just many things you can't control, and it's just going to come at you whether you want it or not, and in a very sporadic variety of ways. So I've really, like, kind of done a deep dive on Mehem and his chosen in the third book and what that's all about.
Nice.
Who we have next? Ordo, goddess of order. Dogma is order is the heart of civilization. We meet the Vingardo in season one, and that is what a fan favorite character Oz is, and he is a Vildfer, so they're kind of like Sasquatch people almost. He's just like, hey guys, this lovable character, he's fucking massive, he's hairy, he's a Vingardo, so he's pretty cool, pretty powerful.
He gives off a surfer dude vibe.
Yeah. Very much so. He's always got like a cigar hanging out of his mouth, he's got an eye patch. He's just one chill dude. But the Vingardo are basically like civilization's first line of defense from Lator's like greater evils, essentially. So for example, he stayed behind, he split with the party when the Three Gates came under siege. So it's kind of his oath to protect civilization in that way.
We also meet another one super briefly in the Ruptured Range.
Yes, we do indeed. Talon does.
My first failed role.
Yeah, the most perceptive character I've ever had the pleasure of playing with.
You can be honest. It wasn't not all pleasure.
It was not all pleasure. Don't let your players have a passive perception of 29.
28.
28? That's a big difference.
It can get to 30. Like, it can be worse.
Up next is Sesara. And she is probably the most prevalent god in Book 1 and 2. Especially Book 2. So she is the goddess of life and sustenance. Her dogma is life begets life. Nurture and be nurtured and let life continue and grow. But of course...
Unless you're Shadowscorn.
Unless you're Shadowscorn. And this gets to... humanoids. I'm not pointing any fingers at humans in particular. Wink, wink. Have a fascinating knack to just twist words into whatever suits them best. And they really run from there. So modern Sesara followers in the books and the podcasts are pretty much tyrants. They lay siege to Shadowscorn, who they think is pretty much their antithesis. These Shadowscorn, the children of shadow, darkness, evil. So they're kind of honestly like the BBEGs of religion in Lator.
Nobody read into that.
No. Yeah, let's just leave it there. Next we have Skalgr, the Diamond Dragon, who we referenced earlier, the god of death. And now this is not someone who comes to you to ferry your soul. No, when you die, you give him power. So, big surprise.
You become a Slurpee.
Yep, pretty much. Big surprise that he is encouraging the War of a Thousand Dragons. Basically, every time a war breaks out, Skalgr gains more power. And his dogma is death is the final king, which is kind of finite and inevitable, unfortunately.
He's not wrong.
He's not wrong. And again, the first dragon blood was his son that he sired with Pyrelia, goddess of fire, who we mentioned earlier, and their son is Regos the Reaper. So he was kind of the first demigod of Lator, and well, spoiler alert, will show up in season 2.
Dope. Let's go. That's only kind of stressful.
Yeah, right? Just a little bit. I'm stressed out about playing him and like creating a stat block for that shit.
And like making sure it's like grandiose enough too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, fucking Kyle. Fucking Kyle. We love Kyle, but fuck Kyle. You were like in that Dragonhorn heist one shot, he was like climbing all over the tomb of Regos the Reaper. I was like this close to just killing Kyle's character on the spot. We come to our final two gods, who are twins, a brother and a sister. So first off, we have Xeres, the god of lies and trickery, dogma nothing is true. And Zemez, goddess of literature and knowledge, dogma knowledge is power disguised. Again, Book 3, they get quite a bit into these siblings and their eternal battle with each other. But yeah, that wraps up our pantheon.
Wow. With your pantheon, as a DM myself, I sometimes add in little new powers, you know, little special little bits. Do you have any special powers that are currently existing in Lator?
So do you mean powers in the sense that like Fae worships a power, the caretaker?
Yes, but also in the sense that like you introduced a new damage type as well that was like soul damage, stuff
soul
like
damage,
that.
Yes. Yeah. That's a good question. We have energy damage, which I feel like needs a better name. But
yeah, it's not great.
It's not great. We got to workshop that one. But that is basically the negators who are from outer space. They're like the pets of the keepers. which I guess we could get into as a part of the pantheon almost. So the keepers,
they have rules that you can't break. Yes. Or shouldn't break.
Yes. So the keepers are like these self-proclaimed benevolent gods almost. Nobody really knows about their history. We've come to a little bit of understanding in episode 12.5 when Ember and Corpse and Adriana discover a lair of one of the, I can't remember exactly how many keepers there are, but essentially they have come from outer space, landed on Latour, have been watching them from afar. They've been watching Latour from afar. And at the end of the first age, Latour pretty much threw itself into a world war, for lack of better terms, and pretty much annihilated all life. So then the keepers showed up and were like, here's a set of rules to follow that will keep you guys on track to success. Don't fuck this up. And if you do fuck this up, I'm going to send my pet Negator to go and erase you from all space and time. So we've met a Negator, Avon, who traveled with the party for a few episodes, proved to be incredibly powerful and helpful.
Cool dude.
Cool dude. Speaks with a cool Iron Man type helmet. It's pretty fun.
Yeah.
So they're just like the only proof of really science on Latour. But anyways, they have these cool laser pistols, some of them, and they have an energy damage type associated with them that we will workshop. Plasma damage?
I feel like plasma isn't energy.
Is plasma energy?
What's that? So if you go by like the science-y stuff, I think they're two different, because it's like plasma cannons and energy cannons. Yeah. Well, like laser cannons.
It says, here we go, Google. A plasma is just generally a mix of these positively charged ions and negatively charged electrons. Most plasmas are created when extra energy is added to gas, which can occur when gases are heated to high temperatures. That does not answer my question. I have no idea.
No. Yeah, blood is plasma with that.
Yeah, right? I write fantasy novels. I don't know.
We're not science folks.
No.
We'll workshop it. Energy's not sticking.
Energy's not sticking. We'll
it's not the greatest. We'll workshop it.
Aside from that, I don't have, and I like to just like throw these damages as we go kind of thing.
All right. Oh, I thought you mentioned like a time thing and stuff like that.
Yeah, so we have powers. We call them powers in Latour. And they're like, they're not gods. They're more like aspects of reality or things that like keep reality moving, if that makes sense.
So like something we would refer to as Mother Nature.
Yeah. Yeah. You could say that.
Shit happens.
Shit happens. And for example, Faye's deity or patron is the caretaker. And that is who we refer to as, she is pretty much the Grim Reaper. She is in charge of the circle of life and death. She lives in a nexus called the Everspring Glade. She has pet Ammons that are very cute little creatures that go and collect fallen souls across Latour and bring them to her.
Don't worry, we're going in on that too.
Yeah, 100%. And like, I guess Faye also has an Ammon called Luna. And Luna likes to take on Faye's nighttime visage as a gloom elf. But a little bit more to explore that we haven't yet. We have a power of time, a power of karma, and a power of love. I am ever growing and building Latour's world and lore, so we will continue to add to that and explore that more in season 2.
Cool. Yeah. Sorry. Well, you answered my next question because we just spoke about them. We know that one's been represented. We haven't really gotten to the other ones yet, but it sounds like we'll find some examples in the coming season. So this is more of a curiosity question for myself. How many different dragon breeds are there? Because I know you've like made some yourself. Like, for example, Willow. Shout out, Willow.
Timber Dragon in the house.
Timber Dragon. So I was curious as to like what other, because like, for example, in D&D, there's like, you got your
you've 10, got like your colored dragons.
Say. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Is it 10? I think it's a little bit more than that. Yeah. I think.
No, because it's five. The deity for the bag ones is five headed.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Bahamut's five headed, and then
right,
there's like the platinum dragon for the other side, but there's platinum.
It's Bahamut is a platinum dragon, right?
Yeah, it's Tiamat. It's
the platinum
other
dragon.
Yeah. There's platinum, evil. Then gold, copper, bronze, silver. I think that's it for the good side. and then there's black, blue, red, green,
white. I think that's it.
Yeah, so including platinum, there is 10.
There's 10, yeah. See, I base everything off of like evolution in Latour, and again, not necessarily just evolution, but like the fact that Latour literally like leaks and oozes magic, and that like gets into the creatures' bodies and souls, and it changes them quicker than evolution might. So we've got the timber dragons, which live in the forests. They like breathe spores that like mold and fester on their enemies' bodies. Which is pretty fucking
awesome.
Is
she on our Instagram, by the way?
Yeah, you can see pictures of Willow on our Instagram. You absolutely can. They're pretty cool looking. We've got glacier dragons, which are pretty similar to white dragons for those who are more familiar with D&D lore.
Giving me PTSD.
Yeah, right? From White Death killing our poor Talon. But again, more like their like wings are made of like ice, and between their scales you can get like kind of like a hue of blue to it, and they'll just kind of like just emanate their territory, I guess is the best way to say it. We've got our lava dragons that like spit lava and like can create like land masses in a matter of hours. We have desert dragons that kind of they fly, but they prefer to like swim through the sand. And they also, their breath weapon is like a sand blaster, which I <don't> just shred your skin off, basically. We have cave dragons, which we met again in that that Dragonhorn heist. They're like blind creatures that just primarily live underground. What else we got? We've got our cloud dragons, which are the only dragons in Latour that don't have front legs. They are the biggest dragons, and for that reason, they rarely, if ever, land. They pretty much just live in the sky 24/7.
They're very Shenron.
Yeah, exactly. And then last but not least, we have the most benevolent and like omnipresent water dragons. And they have no legs and great wings, and they just pretty much live in the oceans. In book two, it is known that there were a few that lived in Latour Lake. That was the biggest lake on Latour, hence its name. But the quake of Harazoon wrecked that, and it got split into two lakes as the middle dried up, forming Latour Lake and Starlight Lake in the process. So at least one water dragon died in the process of that.
That's it
for dragons. Fucking Harazoon, man. And fuck that Red Willow Guild who just couldn't stop it. Those are losers.
Yeah, what the fuck? Imagine being part of the Red Willow Guild. Nerds.
They're going to be so, hiding their faces for a while.
Jumping off on this, you also have some creatures that you sort of blended together or that you've kind of just created yourself. We've met the puma sheep, Ammon, and the bison bear. What else do you got? What else is there?
Yeah, puma, sheep, bison, bear, probably my favorites. We have that you and I workshopped together, Devin, which is the Rhyena, which is a rhino-hyena hybrid, which I am so looking excited to get some art for and throw that at you guys in season two. What else we got? We have the Kamikus that made an appearance in, again, episode 12.5. They are, so Kamiku, I don't know, I just saw my notes, roughly translates to blind turtle frog in Old Elvish.
Nice. Oh, yeah, I remember these.
Yeah, they've basically got hard turtle shells and frog-like bodies, and they spit acid at you.
Yeah.
Let me check out my monsters. We've got the saber-tooth ram, which was fun, we didn't get too much time with that. Again, the last five or so episodes were just fucking wild. What else we got? I think that's it for my blended creatures. And I love to just like mix creatures. That really stems from Avatar The Last Airbender. I love their like platypus bears and
moles.
Turtle ducks.
I like the lemur. I love the bison. They're all so good.
Yeah, really good.
So good.
So I enjoy that for that reason. And they're just cute as shit. They're always cute.
Yeah, they are. Yeah. So you also have, we're just going off on the creation here. We also got other like races you created, like the Keys, the Kintar, which are a loose representation of elves, but I also know that you have the Shadow Scorn, which is a little more out of the box, I would say.
A little more original.
Yeah. What got you to the Shadow Scorn? Because Skaft is in the first book. She could have been any other race. She would be anything. Yeah. And you went, that's I'm going to create these shadowy, half kind of dead creature things that aren't actually half dead.
Yeah, that's a really good point. What was my inspiration for the Shadow Scorn? Again, so we talked about the Shadow Scorn being the children of Aesir. Again, read the books and you'll kind of understand why these gods are putting out their children into the world, trying to create their own species, I should say. The Shadow Scorn originated. They were all snow elves from Moon Mountain. The snow elves of Moon Mountain were gifted an old mine from the dwarves of the Karaman Range. And so these snow elves were like, well, let's just go check out this mine. Maybe there's some good shit in it. And they hired a bunch of miners to come with them. They arrived there that first night. They all endure a eternity of damnation and roaming the world as ghosts. And the following morning, they all wake up turned into Shadow Scorn. So the Shadow Scorn can be any race in Latour, essentially. They are marred or scarred by shadow. Their hair mists eternally into the ethereal shadow around them. They can turn their skin from a stark white to a gray to a onyx, just impenetrable black. I don't know what like the original thought was for that, but I knew like I wanted Skaath. So without giving too much away, she is the princess of Shadow Scorn. And that is just like the oldest fuck off trope there is in fantasy. So I was like, let's give her like an actual reason why people want to hunt this princess down aside than from just greed. And let's make her really cool and really powerful as all hell.
So you invented a whole race.
So I invented a whole race. And Skaath really starts as a Mary Sue archetype, which is, I want this on the record, completely intentional, because she is never given an opportunity to be herself or find her potential until this enticing, or I shouldn't say enticing, like first chance she gets is when she's abducted and now has to walk back across Latour with Ven, Athvar, and Aegon, and really is given the opportunity to grow into the person she can be and becomes one of the most powerful people in Latour. Yeah, I guess I just love Shadow. I love the idea of that. It's cool as all hell.
As someone who's most of his home, like, games that I've played are more Faerunian, I would say. Yeah. They feel like Shadar Kai in a way, like, which is, for those of you who don't know, like the elf children of the Raven Queen, essentially. They live in Shadowfell. They're like the antithesis of your Eladrins, yeah. Your more fey type. So they definitely mean that vibe, and that's personally why I like them, because I always try to play a Shadar Kai.
Yeah.
It's my favorite thing.
You mentioned that the first campaign I ever ran, which was a year-long campaign for everyone that's in the podcast, minus Kyle, and you, of course. No offense, sorry, Devin.
It's fine.
It was on the Sword Coast, and one of the main gods in that was the Raven Queen, and she did have a disciple who was an NPC named Scath.
Oh, really?
Yes. Yeah, that's as soon as you mentioned the Raven Queen, I was like, oh, fuck yeah, that's right. So that's where that name came up with, where I came up with it, and which is a Celtic name, by the way. And then I was like, oh, this is a really cool like concept. I have a Shadow Genasi on D&D Beyond as a playable race. Like a couple hundred people have like downloaded it and put it into their campaigns. It's a really fun race to play. It must have just snowballed from there.
Oh, that's fair. Makes sense. We don't got much time left, so I'll rapid fire some of these. What's the process you take to create your NPCs?
I say like the biggest one is pick a favorite character I like from like a TV show or a movie or maybe even a book. Try to impersonate them. Do a terrible job. And then the terrible job that I've done and all those inaccuracies become this new person.
That's fantastic. I just want to say I believe he was a gnome shopkeeper in like the first episode. The guy that sells them Rent-A-Tent. Fucking love that voice. So funny.
Yeah, he's excellent. Garrick. Garrick's Goods and Gadgets.
Garrick, yeah.
Yes,
yeah. Nice. That guy's great. And for the listeners, for myself, for yourself, how long do you plan on continuing the podcast? We got one season at least still coming.
I mean, how long are my players going to let me torture them? How long are you, the audience, going to want to listen to me torturing them? Because I could do this shit all day.
I got time.
Nice. Me too.
I got time.
I can see us doing this for the foreseeable future.
Same. Well, Quinn, thanks for joining me on Lore Dump. Listeners, I hope you enjoyed your little insight into the process and the world of Latour.
Round of applause for our fantastic radio host.
You're welcome. And we'll see you next time. Popping out of the ether.
Bye-bye.